Place to Be podcast is now a proud member of the historyofwwe.com website. The historyofwwe.com features thousands of complete cards and detailed results from throughout wrestling history for multiple major promotions, in addition to outstanding columns and reviews. It is now also the official home of the Place to Be podcast and Scott and Justin's pay-per-view reviews. Visit us at the historyofwwe.com or on Facebook by searching for the Place to Be podcast or the History of WWE, because the Place to Be is now the History of WWE.
He's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The billiard?
Not billiards. It was... Come on, everybody. Come on. We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the Place to Be podcast here on this beautiful Thursday evening. We are very happy to have you with us as always, and extra happy to be here tonight because it's always a good night when we hop inside the Vintage Vault. And to do that, of course, I do need to bring on my PIC, the man who is a Winnie the Pooh guy, and of course that is Scott Criscolo. Scott, welcome.
That is true, and a good evening to you, Mr. Azzaro, as always. And a good evening to all of you for another exciting edition of the Place to Be podcast.
Number 51.
51, the Dick Butkus episode.
Yes.
I've decided from now on just to flaunt my age just because I think it's fun. I think every time we get to a number, I'll come up with an athlete or something relating to the number that's very old, and you can come up with something relating to the number that's very new.
Okay.
I think that because, I mean, you know, because even what the hell? All right, I'm older. Whatever. What are you going to do? So this is, for me, this is the Dick Butkus episode.
Well, since you do age and dog years, every episode will just be your new birthday.
I don't know who's a new 50, I don't know who's a great number 51 of current day. I don't know.
Bernie Williams.
Yeah, there you go. Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
There you go.
And of course, this is another great episode because it is just a day away from the beginning of the Rotella wedding weekend.
Yeah, I can't believe we have gotten here. You and I have been talking about Rotella Palooza, which was the June 4th. Bachelor party for which seemed like 7 months going back, you know, even before obviously our Place to Be podcast started in February. You and I were talking about it in October, November, and then that has come and gone, and now the moment that he finally does the deed, and that is this weekend. So we will give you a full report on Monday's episode 52, which will be, of course, our special SummerSlam preview special.
Listomania.
And, Listomania, part two. We did WrestleMania. This one is SummerSlam. And we'll give you highlights of the weekend then. Speaking of, though, the hottest night of the summer, that is the topic of this evening's number
51. Speaking of weddings.
That is right. Look at this. Only here. Only here on the Place to Be podcast do you have this kind of perfect symmetry.
Yes.
Because tonight on the Place to Be podcast, we open up the Vintage Vault.
And I forgot the fucking keys again.
Ah! All right, I have the... All right,
get the spare. Out from under the rug.
All right, the year that I pledged my fraternity.
But that's 16, only two numbers, so it's not a very good... Oh.
1640... No, Columbus and I.
Okay.
It was the Italian fraternity. Okay, doors open. All right. Tonight, on the Place to Be podcast, the Vintage Vault brings you a match made in heaven, just like this weekend. And for sure... Match made in hell.
Just like this weekend.
Turn
Nuptials turn to napalm. That may be one of Vince's best openings.
Yes, because I love when he when he talks about hell, he would exemplify it throughout the rest of his on-air career. But that's the first time he really said the hell. It was perfect. It's tremendous. Of course, hearing that wonderful open tonight on the Vintage Vault here on the Place to Be podcast, Mr. Zeros and I, probably one of our five favorite pay-per-views of all time.
Yeah,
for me
there.
Anyway. I'm pretty sure it's. I know it's up there for you. And that is SummerSlam 1991. Live from venerable Madison Square Garden, the home office. And to get in the mood tonight, as we've told you in the past, usually when Justin and I do the Vintage Vaults, I usually have one of us, we each have something probably playing in the background. And I don't know what you have on right now, but tonight I threw on one of our 24/7 comps. And this week, it is a house show, an MSG house show from March of 1986 from Madison Square Garden. So, getting us in the mood. This is a bad women's match. It involves Velvet McIntyre and some other chick against two Japanese women, so I have no idea who it is. Oh, it's Bull Nagano. How about that, huh?
You know what? That's actually not a bad match. Yeah.
I got it on now.
What's it? Is it Dump Matsuda, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Dump. I think it's Dump Matsuda and Bull Nagano against Velvet McIntyre and some girl I don't recognize.
Yeah,
something Gonzalez.
Bull and Dump had a little run there in '86, and they actually had some pretty good matches, I think.
Sounds like a movie that would have like Galifianakis in it. Yeah, Bull and Dump. Anyway, one thing that is not full of Bull and Dump is tonight's Vintage Vault.
Tom Selleck and Matt Rotella starring Bull and Dump.
It's a great combination, too. Two guys with facial hair. August 26th.
And male pattern baldness.
Yes, that's true, too. August 26th, 1991, live from venerable Madison Square Garden in New York City. Our first trip to the Garden in 3 years since the first SummerSlam in 1988. Wow, 3 years. That's a long time. Mm-hmm. And then they get into the groove where they go every, well, they don't come again for 3 years, and then they kind of do every 2 years after that for a while. New York City, of course. Sellout crowd of an even 20,000. So the place, and let me tell you, so this crowd, just like WrestleMania 7, even just like the 91 Rumble, another ridiculously hot crowd tonight.
Yep.
Top of the line. But it's the Garden. When do you not have one? Buy rate 2.7. And your announcers, a pretty good, actually probably one of the best. If you go back through history, might be one of the best three-man booths in either pay-per-view or television history. Gorilla Monsoon, Bobby the Brain Heenan, and Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Mm-hmm.
It really was a great three-man booth for this night. I thought so, anyway. Top of the line.
I agree.
You had Gorilla the straight babyface, you had Bobby the comedic heel, and you had Piper, who just kind of went with match per match, really. He spent most of the night, needling Bobby, but he was pretty much down the line. You know, he would pick his battles. No dark matches. And tonight, Justin will do the odds, and I will do the evens. So why don't you hand us our smoking hot six-man opener?
And, of course, that six-man opener is comprised of two very intriguing teams. The heel team is a slick stable of the Warlord and Power and Glory. All three men still maybe it tapered off a little bit, especially Power and Glory. But here they look good and work very well as a unit. And they are taking on the babyface triumvirate of the British Bulldog, of course, we talked about him who made his return earlier in the year, Texas Tornado Kerry Von Erich, and a unknown mystery man, this guy, the Dragon, this youngster that no one knows anything about.
Exactly.
Just showed up. That's actually not true, because as I've watched those Superstars episodes, they actually did talk about him in his past. And of course, the Dragon is Ricky Steamboat, making his first pay-per-view appearance since WrestleMania 4. After that, leaving the WWF, he went to the NWA, and had probably the greatest three-match series ever with Ric Flair, of course. And, God, I'll let you talk about those very quickly.
Yes. He came out of nowhere at the beginning of 1989 in a tag match. It was actually Flair and Barry Windham against Eddie Gilbert and a mystery partner, and out came Ricky the Dragon, and the place went bonkers, and that would lead to a World Heavyweight Championship match at the Chi-Town Rumble pay-per-view in Chicago, which Steamboat won the much-coveted and much-deserved NWA World Heavyweight Championship, and a guy who spent so many years with just one awesome match after another. The guy finally got the brass ring. Mm-hmm. They would then have one of my favorite matches of all time at Clash of the Champions 6 down in New Orleans at the Superdome the same night as WrestleMania 5. They would have a 2-out-of-3 falls match, 57 unbelievable minutes of wrestling, won by Steamboat 2-1. And then finally on May 7th at WrestleWar down in Memphis, Flair would win the title back with a roll-up. And that would lead to a great feud between Flair and Terry Funk, but that's another story for another day. Then Steamboat would kind of bounce around. He would actually feud a bit with, I think he feuded a bit with William. No, that was after he came back.
No, I think he Wyndham maybe.
Yeah, he might have Wyndham might have been going.
Luger. I think he fought Luger in there.
Yeah, he bounced around a bit with some good matches and then left, and then came back to the WWF in the spring of 1991.
Yeah, Vince came calling. Now, you know, for a long time, we were under the impression that Vince, you know, instructed his announcers not to really talk about Steamboat's past or who he was, but we were wrong in that. Watching the old Superstars episodes, he was very clear that it was Ricky Steamboat, and he actually talked quite often when Savage was also on commentary. The two of them would discuss, you know, their match at WrestleMania 3, so...
Exactly.
We were definitely off on that. He did. Was you know, they still talked about him kind of vaguely, but not here. I don't think they mentioned anything at the show. But on Superstars, they were pretty clear. So
yes.
Also, the final pay-per-view appearance for him and Paul Roma.
Yes.
Paul Roma's final record 4-6, 0-2 at the Rumble, 0-2 at WrestleMania, 1-1 at SummerSlam, and 3-1 at the Survivor Series. And Steamboat's record is 6-1, of course. You know, we compiled that record prior to his little retirement run a couple years back. So including that, I guess, what was he? Did he win one? No, he lost both, right?
He lost, so he'd be 6-3.
Yeah, he lost both.
He lost the WrestleMania match, the six-man, and then he lost to Jericho at Backlash, which we saw live, which was a treat.
Yes.
So, yeah, 6-3.
So, yep, so Ricky Steamboat, we'll get into why he left when we get to our next show, because he was scheduled for that show.
Right.
So we'll get there. And unfortunately, this show also marks the end of another iconic character. The Slickster.
Yes.
You know, we can't mourn too much, though, because he is, you know, he is still around for quite a while. This is just his final pay-per-view appearance.
Right.
As a manager. Let's go. Tribute.
Very sad.
Yes, he would stick around primarily as the manager of the Warlord until the 11-4 primetime when he got power slammed by the British Bulldog. Harvey Whippleman would then replace Slick as Warlord's manager. Slick would return a month later on the 12-16 primetime as Reverend Slick, turning face and renouncing his evil past and his evil ways, and basically became a play on his real life as Slick was actually an ordained minister. He would be a mainstay in primetime wrestling throughout 1992, often hosting when they had like the little round table.
Right.
And he would do the pre-show sermon at 92 Survivor Series. He'd stick around through early 93, serving as a manager of Kamala, who we'll get to next year when we do these reviews. And he would remain with Kamala till early 93 when both men left the promotion. He would return at WrestleMania 23, which we'll get to someday.
Sometime down the line.
And also on a couple of old school Raws here and there. So he would pop up from time to time. But as far as an on-air character, this marks the end of the great Doctor of Style.
Yes. And I have to be honest with you. He should be managing these two teams because this might be one of the best 80s women's matches I think I've ever seen. This tag match. I mean, it's pretty stiff.
Yeah, yeah. The Bull and Dump had a... Selick and Rotella had a good run.
Yes. Slick, and you know what? Slick was one of the first guys that sang his entrance theme.
Mm-hmm.
And probably one of the most iconic entrance themes of all time.
Yeah, Jive Soul Bro.
And of course, it is a AJ Faye favorite, so... I kind of dig this six man tag. It's pretty good. You got some dead weight in there. I mean, you know, Tornado, I think he probably drove to Albany first, but, you know, obviously, you know, Steamboat could wrestle these matches with his eyes closed. Bulldog was on a good groove, hot, you know, crowd kind of sad to see pretty much the end of Power and Glory here. So much promise, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And just, you know, they couldn't have come any earlier, really, because the tag division is so stacked, as we saw teams like the Rougeaus get screwed. But yeah, you know, they just... Yeah, I don't know.
No, it's upsetting. No, it is. I agree with you. No, it's hard to say because they really, you know, I don't think they were meant to be this good as a heel team.
No, definitely not.
I think you could thank the Rockers for that because during 1990, you know, they really put the Power and Glory over. So
and really, what a difference a year makes for a few of these guys. Power and Glory obviously looked dominant a year ago, destroying the Rockers. The Warlord, you know, destroyed Tito Santana and looked primed to a very good singles run. And by this point, you could tell he's kind of a little bit on fumes. And Texas Tornado a year ago was a whirlwind, no pun intended, coming into the ring, destroying Mr. Perfect, winning the Intercontinental title in 5 minutes. And then here he's just kind of an afterthought. So, you know, quite the change for those four guys over the last year.
Yes. And here it's kind of like the swan song, last big paycheck, and they got kind of shunted out the door. So
I mean, Bulldog, to me, is the guy that they're kind of showcasing here. I mean, everyone looked good, but Bulldog, you could kind of tell. And Dragon as well got a lot of offense in. But Bulldog, to me, was kind of the guy that was the showcase here.
Yeah, I agree. And he was obviously his year would continue to flourish. He would continue his interaction with the Warlord. And of course, we would not see the last of the two of them in a ring together. So pretty good opener, you know, 2.5, nothing ridiculously good, but, you know, fun. And, you know, let's be honest, it's Madison Square Garden crowd. Give them something halfway decent and their energy will spike the match an extra half point. That's just how it works at Madison Square Garden shows. And this is one of those cases. Otherwise, this is probably a nondescript 6-man tag, but, you know, add the MSG crowd who is smoking hot And it's an extra half point. So
yep, and I like the finish is good. Dragon hitting the crossbody on Roma to get the win, and you know, it's actually a unique match, and this is something I actually picked up as a kid watching this show, and it's always kind of stuck with me. If you notice, both teams always tag in order. So Roma and Dragon start, and Dragon tags to Tornado. Tornado tags to Bulldog. Bulldog tags to Dragon. You know what I'm saying? They go in the same rotation. And same on the heel team.
Yep.
They don't mix it up. Isn't that weird?
That is funny. It's almost like just make sure. It's almost like they meant to do it so Tornado wouldn't get confused. He's probably told, you're going to go in after this.
Well, it's almost like they tried. It's almost like they tried to match up the similar talents, like Roma and Dragon, you know, Tornado and Hercules, and then Warlord and Bulldog. So kind of a unique 6-man, but definitely the prototypical of this era to start the show off. A hot match, a bunch of good characters, a bunch of good athletes. Give him 10 minutes and let him get the crowd revved up.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And a good match again. The crowd gives it a good, you know, they see Steamboat. And, you know, this is MSG crowd, too, so they're not stupid. They know who it is. And so, yeah, a solid opener, good enough for the crowd to get going and the start of what would be a great night of wrestling. So, nice 6-man tag to start. Not on any comps. Of course, as we always do every week, when we do our vintage vaults, I will let you know. Obviously, this pay-per-view is on DVD. It's on the little beer cooler set that came out. But we'll let you know if you don't want to get the whole show. We recommend getting it because it is a pretty damn good show. We'll let you know what matches are on, you know, compilations and such. Our next match is on many compilations.
Yes,
because it might be one of the 10 greatest matches of all time. Definitely one of the two or three best SummerSlam matches of all time. And that is also our first title match of the evening. We actually have an unprecedented... Well, no, we only have three. I forgot. Never mind. I was going to say four, but I forgot that that Hogan's belt was not on the line. Never mind. So it is unprecedented because we actually have three title matches without Hogan defending his. So we'll explain that in a few matches. But our first title defense... Mr. Perfect is tonight defending his World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Championship against, finally, after speculation and hints and teases and all this other nonsense and, you know, a couple of minutes in a Survivor Series match here and there, finally, the trigger is pulled on Bret the Hitman Hart's solo push. So Bret Hart and his promos, admittedly, and I remember watching them because I watched the Superstars leading up to this show on the Classics On Demand. And no, they weren't great, but it's Bret. It's okay. Bret gets a pass.
Yeah, they were good enough.
Yeah, because you knew when these two and the great. Tell me if I'm right. Was it this before this match, or was it before the King of the Ring '93 match where they do the whole "My dad could beat your dad"?
King of the Ring.
That was the King of the Ring. Okay. Yeah. The one thing I liked about the build before we actually get to the match itself. Tell me if you agree with me on this. The one thing I liked about this match, about the build to this match, and I remember the promos on all the, and this might, next to WrestleMania 6, this might be my favorite Mean Gene pay-per-view reports leading up, were these ones leading up mm-hmm. to this show, because I loved them. I loved hearing the SummerSlam music, and it was just great. The one thing I liked about the build to this match is that even though, you know, Bret was a good guy and Perfect was the heel, they gave each other respect in every promo. Perfect yes. would say, Bret, you are the excellence of execution. You are one of the best, but you're not perfect.
Right.
And Bret would say, Perfect, you are one of the greatest Intercontinental Champions of all time, but I am the excellence of execution.
Yeah, and he would say, you know, you're the best right now, but I'm going to beat you.
Yeah. So, not you know, they threw their jabs at each other, but it was clear that we were about to, we were, it was not going to be a surprise. This was probably going to be a pretty damn good match.
And I will say this, though. Watching this in retrospect and knowing what we'll get to in a second with Mr. Perfect, what was going to happen,
right?
It seems obvious. But I remember at the time, this was definitely no givy. gimme.
Givy?
Given. Yeah, givy. This was definitely no givy, for sure. Because
yes.
Bret Hart was still the guy coming right out of a tag team, you know, kind of making his name. And Perfect had been the IC champ for 9 months, defended it against the Boss Man at WrestleMania and held on to it. Mm-hmm. And had a pretty good run. So, I mean, honestly, this wasn't the lock that it seemed to be now.
No, it wasn't. You know, Perfect, probably his first title reign, of course, was a little herky-jerky. They had to give the belt 1 year ago to Tornado. Since winning it back in November, or, you know, in the TV pantheon, December, mm-hmm. He really was on fire. I mean, he really yes. put awesome credibility back into the title.
Yeah, and this is what we talked about at WrestleMania, why it was okay for him to keep it and not have right. Bossman cap that feud with a win.
Right.
Because it did make it more important for this match here.
Yes. The match itself certainly lived up to the hype. It was a tremendous battle between two second-generation stars.
Now, two fun facts, though, you didn't mention.
Yes, well, I know you. I wasn't sure when we were going to get into to that part, but yes,
okay,
the first
cool.
one,
yep.
the first one is Perfect. As great as this match was, we weren't sure because it turns out after the fact, many years later, when we all became smarts, Perfect was coming in with a very severe disc injury in his lower back, so he was in pain, and he was going to take some time off after this match.
But it does not hold him back at all.
No, not at all.
He goes all out for 18
yes.
minutes.
And we would, you know, it's funny. I just had a little vision in my head, almost symmetry. This match is a lot like, in terms of the dynamic in the ring between Stone Cold and Shawn at yep. WrestleMania 14. Stone Cold, the up and comer, Shawn, the established guy, with a really, really messed up back. And just like Shawn did at 14, 7 years earlier, Perfect did the same thing. He gave Bret everything he could.
Yep. To make
he wrestled the last. Yep. He wrestled the last 16 minutes of that match with half his singlet ripped off,
and his puffy afro.
And his puffy, yeah, his hair really got fluffy in that one. Yeah, the frizz fluffed out. Must have been a humid night at the Garden. The other fun fact is something that you'll get used to over the next 6 years in the WWF fan base and in the crowds, and that is the presence of the Calgary's first couple. And that is, of course, our favorite old grizzled son of a bitch, Stu Hart,
yes.
would be in the crowd. And, of course, his lovely wife, Helen, a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up out on the island. And they were in the crowd for this match. I believe wasn't Lord Alfred sitting with them?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
In a couple minutes. But, yeah, he was up there for the after part. But, yes, Stu, of course, and we as fans knew who Stu was. We weren't like, oh, who's that old guy?
Yeah.
Because Jesse used to talk about Stu all the time.
Oh, yeah.
On house shows, and I'm sure this house show that I have on now, if the Heart Foundation's at this show, I'm sure he'll mention it. But he used to mention the Dungeon and Calgary all the time whenever Brett and the Anvil were on camera. So Stu was no, you know, even young fans like us, we know who Stu and Helen were. So
yes.
Calgary's first couple were in attendance at the Garden. The match itself speaks for itself. It was an unbelievable battle. Brett definitely was ready. Perfect. You know, the guy was a stud. I mean, he gave everything to the Hitman that he possibly could. And he was in a lot of pain. He didn't show it as much as Sean did in the 14 match. Sean, you could tell, was hurting.
Right.
Perfect did a pretty good job. I mean, you could tell he was a little stiff in terms, not stiff, hitting Brett stiff, but stiff like, you know, moving his legs a little bit and kind of walking a little gingerly. So you could see it occasionally that Perfect was hurt. Not as bad as Sean was, you know, 7 years later, but definitely he was not 100%, but it didn't matter. This is why, and I've talked with a good friend of mine, my former radio show co-host, Johnny Reckless. Kurt Hennig is one of his favorite wrestlers of all time, and this match is one of the reasons why. Not just because it was a 4-star match. Some people say 5. I don't get it that high just because of the health factor. We'll
right.
get to their pay-per-view rematch, which we'll get to the way we fire these off in a few weeks probably. to me is much better, but we'll get to that one. This one is exceptional because you know, Perfect just put so much into it, and he had to have been in agony.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know.
Now of course here Bobby Heenan, not with Mr. Perfect anymore, coach is on at ringside.
Yes.
And Bobby, of course, is rooting Perfect on from the commentary table, though.
Did we mention Coach last week? Should
yeah.
we talk about
well,
that?
Well, we talked about that he was taking over.
Okay.
But Coach is played by legendary wrestler John Tolos.
John Tolos, who is well known for a violent feud in the 60s out in L.A. with Freddie Blassie.
Yes.
The two used to bite each other and drink each other's blood. And it was vicious in the old LaBelle family L.A. promotion. And then he became Coach. So,
and this is it for him, though. After this, he actually came in a team we'll see next month at the Beverly Brothers, but by Survivor Series, he's gone. So,
right. Yep.
Short run for the coach. And then, of course, with this, you know, with Perfect's back being the way it is, he would be on sabbatical for a while after this show. So,
yep.
Coach really, after leaving the Beverly Brothers, didn't have much going on. So he just kind of simmered out into retirement.
Yes.
But one spot I wanted to talk about here. I'm sorry, go ahead, if you want.
No. I was going to finish recapping, but I was going to do the ending. But if you want to, go ahead, mention what you're going to say.
I was going to say a big spot is Brett kicking out of the Perfect Plex.
Yes.
At that point, that's maybe kind of where you knew, you know, that maybe, you know, Perfect was in trouble and maybe, you know, something was going on that we weren't aware of because, and it made sense to have him kind of, you know, kill his finisher a little bit with Perfect, you know, not knowing when he'll be back in the ring again.
Right.
Of course, the only other guy we've really seen on major TV do that is Hogan and Warrior, of course, had kicked out of the Perfect Plex.
Right. Duh.
For Brett to do it, yeah, and be on this level is pretty big.
Right. And, of course, we already had something like this in our mind similarly because just a few months earlier, WrestleMania 7, we saw Warrior kick out of 5 Savage Elbows.
Yes.
So we'd already had on our minds the philosophy of a guy, you know, killing a finisher. But, you know, main event guy kicking out of another main event guy's finisher, you're like, yeah, whatever. In the Attitude Era, we'd see it every other week.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here, a guy like Brett, who on his first major stage as a solo guy, kicking out of the Perfect Plex, the guy's the Intercontinental Champion. Yeah, this was different.
Yep.
And eventually, Brett would ratchet up the Sharpshooter.
His new finisher.
His new finisher, the Sharpshooter, which is... It's kind of like a Texas Cloverleaf, but a little more tightly wound.
Well, Scorpion Deathlock, basically.
Yeah, it's a Scorpion Deathlock, in essence.
Well, I like that spot, too, where Perfect, you know, keeps dropping the leg onto Brett's crotch, and then Brett finally blocks it and grabs
yep.
his leg and then turns him over to the Sharpshooter. And, of course, Perfect calls to the bell, Hebner calls to the bell, like, the second Brett turns it over, you know, Perfect taps out, basically, and yells that he submits. Because obviously they don't want him to keep the hold on that long with Perfect's back being in the mess that it is. So it was pretty much instantaneous. As soon as he turned the hold over, they called for the bell.
Yep. And the place went absolutely ballistic. And on this night, a Hall of Fame career. Well, it began obviously when he was in the tag team, but the next chapter in the career of one of the greatest of all time began on this night. And Bret the Hitman Hart is your new World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion.
Cool little scene there, and actually, I think the part that's not on there is Alfred. He like disses Stu, or he disses one of the Hearts. I forget what it is.
Stu. Isn't Stu answering something mid sentence, and then Alfred just turns around and goes back to gorilla at the table or something like that.
Yeah, something funny like that.
Something funny, but man, that crowd. I just love this show. I'm gonna say that often tonight. It's just this show's just awesome.
Yeah, and I mean, outside of this, this is the one really good match.
Right.
But it's just one of those shows that's a lot of hot action, a lot of good blow-offs, a lot of memorable matches.
Yes. But this was the match of the night. And seeing Bret, you know, hugging his father, and, you know, it's just a great moment. And then little did we realize at this moment what kind of future and what kind of career the Hitman would have from here. Mm-hmm. So congrats to the Hitman, new champ, perfect. Takes a blow, a sabbatical for a while. Well, not a sabbatical from TV, not a long one.
Oh no, yeah, he'll definitely be heavily involved.
Yes, but a sabbatical from being in the ring.
Yes.
So that back was a mess. So your new Intercontinental Champion, Bret the Hitman Hart.
All right, and our next match may seem like a throwaway match, but there's actually a lot going on here, and that is
yes.
The pay-per-view return of the Bushwhackers outside of the Royal Rumble and Survivor Series. We don't really see them too much in regular pay-per-view matches.
Right.
And they are taking on a new team, and that is comprised of Earthquake, who we've talked a lot about, and his new partner, Typhoon, now comprises the Natural Disasters. Typhoon is,
yes.
Of course, the former Tugboat.
Yep.
The Natural Disasters were formed on the 6-5 Superstars officially. Tugboat was teaming with the Bushwhackers in a match against the Earthquake and the Nasty Boys. Midway through the match, Tugboat turned on his teammates, helped Earthquake pin Luke, and then a couple weeks later on Primetime Wrestling, Jimmy Hart introduced him as Typhoon. So
this was one of those turns. I remember watching this match when you and I were going through the Superstar shows on demand, and I remember it was one of those things where every time like Luke would go for a pin, Tugboat would turn around and do the hoo to the crowd and like ignore them, and then a moment would come and he'd beat the crap out of them. Incidentally, before we get to the next match, just want to let you know that we thought that at WrestleMania 7, the Ultimate Warrior Randy Savage match would be the record for the most comps.
Well, the Ultimate Warrior did get his ultimate win.
Ultimate win, Mr. Winkler, on 5 comps, 5 things. Well, the match we just did ties that. The Bret Hart Mr. Perfect Intercontinental title match is on SummerSlam's Greatest Hits, which is obviously a tape. SummerSlam, The Greatest Hits, also a tape. Obviously, Bret Hart's individual DVD, Perfect's individual DVD, and the history of the Intercontinental Championship set that came out a couple years ago. So, also 5 compilations, and obviously it deserves it because it is one of the greatest of all time. Okay, just wanted to point that out. This match But anyway, yeah, and this was due. We've talked about this, you and I, excuse me, on our shows and just in conversations with our friends on boards and stuff. It was time for Tugboat.
Oh yeah, this is a very much needed heel turn. I mean, the Tugboat character in general was just going nowhere. And once you kind of lost that, you know, association with Hogan, I mean, really, what else were you going to do with that character? It was lost. So yeah, it was a good turn, and you know, Quake even was starting to kind of be lost in the shuffle a little bit as well. So I think it was a good move for them to go ahead and turn Tugboat, make him Typhoon, put him with Quake.
Yeah,
I thought it was wise.
No, it was wise, because really Tugboat also was kind of floating aimlessly for a little bit. There really wasn't anything for him to do. However, one thing about this match that's kind of sad, it would be our final on-camera appearance for a guy that I never realized how fond I am of I was of him as a character and as a wrestler as a kid. This would be the last on-camera appearance for Andre the Giant. Now, the rumors were always swirling that Andre was going to make his return. If you remember, you and I talked. You used to mention to me a lot when you were watching those superstars, and then I ended up watching them a short time later.
Yes.
The managers were trying to court him again, and
well,
such.
Let's start from the beginning of that whole thing.
Okay.
On the 427 superstars, Earthquake was facing off with Jake Roberts in a match. Halfway through the match, Quake tied Jake up in the ropes, dragged the bag with Damien into the middle of the ring, and crushed him with a series of Earthquake splashes. Jake was devastated, and that moment could be the main one to point where Jake would later go through the metamorphosis he went through later in the summer. Earthquake's destruction did not end there. During the spring and early summer, rumors were swirling of an impending return for Andre the Giant. Andre had been entertaining offers from various managers to manage him when he finally made his return. So each week they had him, you know, humiliating all the heel managers, basically. He spanked Sherry at a restaurant. He stuffed Slick in the trunk of a car. You know, and of course he humiliated his good old buddy Bobby Heenan one more time. So, but then on the 6-1 superstars, Jimmy Hart made his pitch to the Giant. Andre rejected him. Not one to deal with things like that lightly. Earthquake stuck up for his man Jimmy Hart. He pounced on Andre, knocked him down, and destroyed his knee with a series of elbow drops and using Jimmy Hart's megaphone as well. As a result, both these attacks, the original planned match for this show, according to WWF Magazine, was indeed Jake Roberts and Andre the Giant against the Natural Disasters. Whether or not that was the plan and it was changed or just printed to mislead fans, it was a match that could have been intriguing on many levels. So, you know, obviously we see where Jake ends up, you know, at this point of the year. So it's hard to tell, you know, did they just have that in the magazine just to throw people off the scent with what was going on with Jake, or was there more to it? You know, we'll never know. So that would have been an interesting match though.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Considering that just only what, 2 years earlier, yeah, Jake and Andre were feuding. So, that would have been great, but, alas, Andre would be off camera after this. And, on January 27th, 1993, after his father's funeral, Andre in the post funeral party drank something in the neighborhood of like 90 beers or some nonsense, and would pass away of a heart attack in his sleep that morning. I don't remember how old he was, but
I think he was 46.
Yeah, something like that.
Didn't you think he was a lot older?
Yeah, I did think he was a lot older. I thought he was in his late 50s, but no, you're right, he was in his late 40s because he was actually still kind of active. So, I'll never forget where I was. I was actually in. I was in Providence visiting my friends at PC, and I remember because it was the day of the Super Bowl of the
visiting
first.
Your friends Ernie DiGregorio,
and Marvin Barnes, exactly, and Jimmy Walker, yes.
Andre, yeah, 46 when he passed away.
Yeah, 46. The reason I remember it was because it was the morning of the Super Bowl, the first Bills Cowboys Super Bowl, and I was going back home to watch with my brother, and I remember watching it. It was on SportsCenter. It was actually on SportsCenter that morning. And I was actually, and my friend Steve, who was a huge wrestling fan, had come over to the TV, and we were just sitting there just stunned. I never realized, and now, then when we did our written reviews, and now, of course, doing our wonderful Vintage Vaults, how much I really did appreciate Andre. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody should. And of course, 1993. We'll get to when we get to the quote unquote Hall of Fames when we get there. Andre the Giant would be the first and sole member of the first class of the WWE Hall of Fame, and because he is the boss, he deserved that right and earned it. So, rest in peace, Andre. You are the boss, and you will always be one of the greatest, one of the greatest of all time. And it was very sad. But his body just couldn't handle just life anymore.
Right.
He had that gigantitis. I apologize if I don't pronounce it correctly, but it was sad. It was very sad. But Andre had a. I don't think Andre died with any regrets. Guy probably had one of the most incredible wrestling careers of all time. Guy could go wherever he wanted. Wrestled anywhere he wanted. He was a hired gun. He was in the AWA. He was in the, Mid-South. He was in Canada. He was in Japan. He wrestled for the Crockett's, and obviously he wrestled for Vince Sr. and Jr. Wrestled everywhere because the guy was just a main event star. And for you younger fans that don't really appreciate it, go on YouTube, or if you want to buy that inexpensive Andre DVD that came out, a while ago.
Yeah.
I think it was just a reprint of Coliseum videotape. I would suggest watching it. You're not looking for work. Andre was not the work rate kind of guy. But if you do watch matches from the late 70s, early 80s, Andre did drop kicks. Yeah, he used to come off the second rope. Not off the top rope.
But, well, he had that one spot where he came off the cage and hit the butt splash.
But the butt splash off the cage, yes. Yep. If you get a chance, go to YouTube or something and just watch some Andre matches, because the guy was just an amazing. Don't remember him as the really good heel who really couldn't move at WrestleMania 3 against Hogan. Don't think of him just in that. Go back in time. The guy was a legend. And I didn't want to go too far on it. I apologize, but he's just a guy that deserves some time to be talked about he was one of the greatest of all time. And this was his last on-screen appearance. So so rest in peace, Andre. You'll always be the boss.
The match itself now, Andre. Just get a lot of action. He's down there ringside with the Bushwhackers, get the hat on, kind of a little bit of goofiness, but, it's good to see him having some fun. The match itself is only 6 minutes. It's pretty much what you'd expect. Bushwhackers get a little bit of offense in, not much. The Disasters, you could tell that they were being built up, obviously, to be the next big heel team. So they win this one pretty easily. After the match, they threaten Andre, and then the Legion of Doom comes out and makes the save for him. And you kind of tell that they were angling for a future LOD disaster feud, probably.
Yes.
This is a good team. Earthquake was kind of sputtering as a single star, and as we said, Tugboat was going nowhere. So
exactly.
Made sense to put them together and have them run through the Bushwhackers here.
Perfect-looking team to put together, too. Just two big.
They pretty much look like identical bodies.
Yeah, pretty much. Both had, back boobs and bad mullets and facial hair.
Very true.
On a side note, watching this, this is the second women's tag match that involves a Japanese tag team. This is crazy. So different back in the mid-80s. They're called the Crush Girls. They look like guys, but
yeah, they were supposed to be really good, too.
Yeah, they're wrestling.
They must have had a deal with Japan at that point.
Yeah, they're wrestling Leilani Kai and some other ugly chick. But anyway, the hot heel, new heel team, almost, it's almost like the Natural Disasters have replaced Power and Glory's rung on the heel tag ladder. Power and Glory kind of now is out the door, and now the Natural Disasters have kind of put their way, got themselves in there.
Yes. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so they win, and the Bushwhackers, do their job.
And then coming out of that match, possibly, maybe, to this point, the biggest pay-per-view segment of the year.
Dressing room of the WWF champion Hulk Hogan, and I'm going to embarrass him, and I'm going to show you what kind of a man he is. Hogan, open the door. I'm a busy man. Wait till you see this. On behalf of the real world champion Ric Flair, I would like to challenge you, Hogan, at any time, any place. Who do you think you're embarrassing? You hear me? You wouldn't do that if Ric Flair was standing here. You hear me? Turn that camera off. Turn that damn thing off. Oh, I love it!
Should we talk about it or leave it at that?
Well, why don't we just talk about what led to just this moment?
Okay.
And then next Thursday, I'll pontificate.
Okay.
A couple weeks before, on an episode of Primetime, and trust me, I will never forget this moment as long as I live of watching wrestling. I remember my brother had come downstairs because we have a two-story. He lived upstairs in his own room, and I was downstairs. He came down the living room. He's like, "Hey, what are you watching?" "Oh, I'm watching Primetime." "Oh, so now I'm watching another show." So we watched the main event. It was, some typical generic, house show tag match like they usually had on Primetime. And, Bobby and Gorilla were doing their normal banter and, jibes and stuff. And Bobby's got this, shit-eating grin on his face. And he always had that. And it was usually something stupid. And he said, I remember Gorilla saying, "What are you smiling at?"
And Bobby goes, "No, it wasn't Gorilla and Bobby. I guess I remember that well." That version of Primetime was done by this point. This is when Vince and Bobby are hosting in the studio. In the live audience.
Really? Already?
Yeah.
The hell was I watching that? I must have been thinking of something else then. But maybe it was another show.
Nope.
But I remember Bobby sitting behind a desk. Maybe it was an interview segment. And all of a sudden, just as the credits start to roll, I don't know what it was then. He lifts up the big gold belt. Obviously, the big gold belt is the NWA World Heavyweight Championship belt. And my brother and I just stared at the screen in absolute disbelief. The first time you saw the belt was not here. It was a couple weeks before. And my brother and I looked at each other like, "What?" Because the mags didn't say anything. Unless you bought Meltzer's newsletter at the time, you didn't hear anything. But, and my brother looks at me and goes, "You're not thinking what I think you're thinking." And I think it's happening. And sure enough, he came down. He was watching SummerSlam, because I always hosted it. My friends were over, and I couldn't believe it. I never thought the day would come, but after watching that piece, the day was indeed coming. And we'll leave it at that. And we'll elaborate more on next week's Vintage Vault.
Yes.
At the Survivor Series in Motown. I don't want to go any further.
Maybe we'll get that build up correct. Why don't you do some homework this time?
Yeah. I don't know what I was. I remember him being behind a desk and pulling the belt up.
He could have maybe they had a desk. But this at this point was when they had the they were in the live audience.
Well, I know that they were in the live audience when it happened.
Right.
Eventually in September. But
yeah, I think the changeover was around...
Are you
around...
sure it was that early?
Yes.
Really? Yep. I could have sworn they were still behind the desks by then. I don't
think so.
I thought it was still Gorilla and Bobby when they were doing the Stars and Stripes before 7.
Yeah, that was...
We might have to look
that
up because I'm not sure. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure they weren't in the audience yet.
On February 18th, 91, Primetime changed formats to something vaguely resembling a talk variety show. Yeah, because I definitely remember they were in the live audience leading up to 7, because then they were in Vegas right after it, and that was
okay.
They kept talking, and they switched to Tuesdays.
Okay.
And then November 91, they switched the panel until
okay.
the end.
All right. Could have sworn it was something else. Maybe it was just an interview segment, but I remember him pulling the belt out from under a desk, so maybe it was an interview segment.
Maybe it was just a dream.
It was, maybe it was, maybe I had LL Cool J on because, at this time I was just, it was become turning into, never mind. I'm not going to get into that now. Anyway, we'll elaborate more on this moment and what, obviously, the person that Bobby Heenan was referring to on next week's Vault.
Yep.
When we talk about Survivor Series. We'll leave it at that. We don't want to, this podcast could go on for another hour and a half just on that, so we're not going to do that. Let's get on to our next match. Our second title match of the evening. I guess you can call it an official.
Yeah, definitely an official title.
Title match.
Yep.
The $1 million belt, probably for the first time, right? I think officially.
Well, no, WrestleMania 6.
Was it Bobby? Was him and Jake for the belt? I had a feeling it was.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So second one. They had their first match at WrestleMania 7. Of course, I'm talking about the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and his former bodyguard, Virgil, had a match at WrestleMania 7. And it was, it was okay. It wasn't great. Well, over the summer, they would continue to snipe at each other. And here would be the rematch here at Madison Square Garden. But this time, DiBiase was arrogant enough to put up his million-dollar belt.
Yep.
Obviously, it was a big deal for Virgil because we all know that, you know, DiBiase was supporting Virgil's family, and now he didn't have the money. So this was a huge moment for Virgil, V-I-R-G-I-L. And Piper, who, of course, was kind of, you know, Virgil's pseudo-manager, actually stayed at the table. He didn't get up and you know, stand at ringside.
Right, but he was very vocal throughout.
Extremely vocal, yes. I think
the commentary actually really helped carry this match.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Now the energy level was there. And I'll tell you something. In one year, Piper definitely grew into a pretty good announcer.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yep.
You know, took him some time. You know, his debut was the previous year, SummerSlam, and he was kind of...
And this is it. This is the last one.
Yeah, then he's done, and then he's pretty soon he becomes back in the ring, so as his hip surgery started to heal. So, this match, I mean, they obviously practiced since March in Los Angeles, because this match is head and shoulders better.
Yeah.
Virgil kind of got his groove on.
Well, Virgil, too, at this point, you know, he wasn't looked at as any kind of veteran, but he was still looked at as more of a threat than at WrestleMania when he had just, you know, in the eyes of the fans, started wrestling and was kind of a real underdog. Still right. An underdog here, but, you know, he's more, you know, he had been wrestling throughout the summer and they were building him up more. And so it is kind of a little bit more believable that he could hang with DiBiase here.
Right. And the match was just very good. Sherry was, of course, there. No, not for long at all.
They do the false finish in the middle where Sherry comes in, hits Virgil, and there's a DQ, and the crowd, of course, is devastated by that.
Yep.
But then the ref says, fuck that. He throws Sherry out and restarts the match. So yep. That was a pretty good moment.
The end of this match is awesome. DiBiase's baiting Piper from the ring because he's beating the crap out of Virgil. And he's like, you know, this is done. This is finished. I've had it with him. You know, he's just pummeling Virgil. He's hitting his punches, his elbows. I think he did the stun, the snap suplex, the slingshot. I mean, he's beating the shit out of Virgil at this point. And he goes to a corner, takes the turnbuckle pad off, exposing a little steel ring. He attempts to ram Virgil's head into it. Virgil reverses it, throws DiBiase's head into it, and DiBiase's done. But Virgil, who had gotten the shit kicked out of him for about a good 5 minutes, has nothing left in the tank. And this is where, like you said, the commentary carries this match. Piper is just absolutely crapping his kilt, begging Virgil, just crawl over. And finally, he gets the energy. He gets on Virgil. He gets on DiBiase. Gets the three count. And we have a new million-dollar champion. And it's just a moment to behold.
Yeah, I mean, the crowd red hot, like you said, Piper red hot. Virgil, you know, can't believe he pulled it off. Yeah, really just a great moment. Very, maybe oft-forgotten moment as well. Mm.
And of course, you know, and what made it even more special moment is Fink,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Doing the announcement like it's, you know, new million-dollar champion, and it's awesome. Another moment to add to an already awesome show
mm-hmm.
on this night. And again, the crowd. Can you just hear that crowd? You can't hear anybody.
Yeah, no, they were going crazy.
I mean, they were just bonkers. And once again, like we said on last week's Vintage Vault about Perfect and Boss Man, same instance at WrestleMania. Why kill a conceivably long-lasting feud by giving Virgil the win at WrestleMania and then no one remembers it?
Yep.
So same thing here. And it worked because, again, you needed to give this show some juice, and boy, did it
very deliver. Memorable.
Yeah. So we have two title matches and two title changes. We have a new Intercontinental Champion, and now we have a new $1 million champion, Virgil. V-I-R-G-I-L.
How do you spell man? So, great match there. And, of course, that leads into another great match, coming off another hot feud.
This is a J-Fave special here for you, my friend.
Yes.
This is right up your alley.
And this is between the two bastions of law enforcement in the WWF.
Yep. Yes.
And, of course, coming out of WrestleMania, Mountie looking to start up his first major feud, started calling out the Big Boss Man, talking shit, saying he was a real law enforcement person in the WWF. They did the thing back and forth. And it was decided they'd face off here in SummerSlam in a jailhouse match where the loser would spend the night in the New York City clink.
Yep, in the pokey.
So a lot of good build-up, a lot of good promos leading up to this one. Cool little feud. I really like this match. And Boss Man, as we've talked about, was really in getting to great shape here. I thought it just looked really good in the ring. And these two, I thought, worked well together in the ring as well.
Yes. I agree with you 100% on the build. Because remember, the Mountie, prodded him on an episode of, I think it was Superstars.
Yep.
Was it Jimmy that baited him into getting in the ring or something? I don't remember what it was. Chased him into the ring, and then Mountie cut him off at the pass, and then jabbed, handcuffed him to the rope, and then repeatedly jabbed him with the cattle prod. Mm-hmm. So that was back in, what was that, like late April, I guess, early May, something like that. And that would lead to, the build would be, and the promos were tremendous. And then the match, once again, another match that delivered on the hype.
Yes.
And I liked the Mountie, and he would pay the price here, but he would have a better.
It was on May 11th.
May 11th, yeah. Okay.
Boss Man defeated Dan Johnson in 45 seconds. After the bout, the Nasty Boys attacked the Boss Man, handcuffed him to the top rope, and Mountie came and shocked him with a stick.
That's right. I do remember the Nasty Boys coming out. That's right. So a great match. Two and a half. Nothing great. No, the work rate was nothing fancy, but nobody cared. They just wanted to see, the Mountie get his.
Yeah, just a lot of strikes. And actually, the finish was really nasty. Boss Man snaps him over with an Alabama Slam kind of spine buster. It really rattles him. He fucking spikes him.
Yeah.
Cool finish there. And it was good because they needed a move that would kind of knock Mountie out to kind of set up the, what was to come. So, cool match. Really played off well off the feud. And, it was a short feud. Well, it started in May, and they were just kind of sniping with each other back and forth, so I can't really say it was too short, but it ends here. It doesn't carry on past this.
No. Nope.
Both men kind of go different directions, so.
Yes.
And, of course, the stipulation would be upheld. And, of course, we get clips throughout the rest of the night. My favorite one was when they were trying to do his fingerprints. And
yes,
They say, give me their finger. You want the finger? Here's the finger. Actually, this might be it right here.
Oh, he's on his way right now. Let's take him
I thought that was it. But
oh, okay.
That's what I remember. He has the finger, and he flips off the cop, and then, of course, then he's in the cell, and the guy in the leather chaps comes up to him and says something about, "Do you like the feel of leather?" or something. So it was pretty funny. It was good. You know, they played it up well, and kudos to the Mountie for going along with it all. So
yes, Jacques Rougeau, tremendous character here, and he took his win like a man. He took his loss like a man, and his trip to the pokey.
Yep, another memorable scene.
Yes, and another great moment on a continuously tremendous evening of, man, this must have been some show to see live.
Yeah, a lot of great blow-offs, a lot of great stories.
I mean, this is just awesome from top to bottom. Well, maybe not the end, but we'll get to that in a minute. Next up is our third and final championship match here at SummerSlam 1991, and it pits the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Knobs and Sags, the Nasty Boys, and Jimmy Hart already having a bad night as his other charge, the Mounties, already gone and ready to hammer license plates and cook dinner with Bubba and his chaps. But his last vestige, again, his prized tag team champions, the Nasty Boys, Sags and Knobs, taking on...
I've been watching you for as long as I can remember. You're all a real man in need, and never ask for it.
Trying to complete the crush.
This is love. This is more than a crush.
I can't get a strike. I can't keep a strike once he says that line. He just hit, this is more than just a crush. He says it so loudly, it's tremendous.
You know, he's just speaking the truth.
Well, he is. Because, you know, my bromance with the greatest tag team of all time, Hawk and Animal, the Legion of Doom, the unequivocal number one contenders to the tag team titles. And I said the trifecta. As I was looking long into the eyes of my Hawk figure, they would become, because at the time, in late 91, there were still obviously the big three, the NWA, the AWA, and the WWF. The AWA was pretty much dead at this point, but they did win the AWA Tag Team Championship. That's even funnier than when he says it. Yes, August 25th, 1984. The Road Warriors defeated Baron Von Raschke and the Crusher to win the AWA Tag Team titles. Then on October 29th, 1988, they defeated the Midnight Express to win the NWA Tag Team titles. So tonight, on this night, they would go for the trifecta, the first team to win all three major tag team championships. And incidentally, this was a no-disqualification match.
Which is weird, because they really don't use the stip at all.
No, it's not like you didn't see any weapons or. No.
The most they used is like the.
They were around the ring.
Yeah, they used like weapons. A tray of drinks. That's like the only weapon they use.
Pretty much.
Very odd. And they don't even do like a brawl. They still tag in and out and everything. It's odd. Odd stipulation. I don't know why they even bothered.
Yeah, it's like they didn't really plan that out properly.
And these two teams could have had a good brawl.
Oh, it would have been ridiculously ugly, and in a good way. They would have beat the crap out of each other. But just like when Michael Kay got to see Derek Jeter get his 3,000th hit, I had my wonderful moment. And when, I'm assuming it was Sags, I believe, was put on. Yes.
Yep.
Sags was put on.
I don't think they could lift Knobs up.
Yeah, no, I doubt it. When Animal lifted Sags on his shoulders.
And right into your lap.
Yep, and Hawk, almost like a gift.
Now, is it true that you watch these LOD matches and do these reviews wearing nothing but the old plastic shoulder pads that they sold?
I don't think we should really be talking about that at this point. You know, we may have mixed, have some women, some ladies listening to these casts.
Are they excited?
I think it's quite, of course, well, you know, you never know. I mean, you know, it was that and my, you know, the Brother Love underwear. But anyway, no. So there you go. The Doomsday Device is launched, and we have new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. Rightfully so.
Yeah, decent. I mean, decent match. Like I said, it could have been better if they did anything with the stip. Right. This was kind of the antithesis.
Indigenous?
Antithesis. Antithesis. What's the word?
Antithesis. Yes. Sounds like when I was mumbling through the Hercules injury last week.
And he grabbed his groin. No, yeah, the antithesis. Antithesis. It's the opposite of the...
yeah, there you go, pretty much.
Bret Hart, Mr. Perfect scenario. We're going to that match. There's a little bit of a question, but here it was pretty obvious that LOD was taking the titles. I mean, there was no doubt that Nasty Boys were lame duck champions from WrestleMania all the way through here. You knew that they were just holding them to keep them warm. So, antithesis.
You can work on it. I'm sure we'll be saying it again at some point in the next before we get to the 100th episode of the Place to Be podcast. But yes,
antithesis.
There you go. Okay, three title matches. Three title changes. Unprecedented.
Yeah.
Don't see that often.
Yep.
Don't see that very often. Yeah, big night. And once again, big pop from the crowd at the end as they're beloved. And on that night, I was willing to share. The Legion of Doom became the new tag team champions. So I just would love to have been in that crowd that night. I mean, that's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Just the pops were just ridiculous and just everything worked right. When we get to the analysis, it just needs to continue being a reference that just every match just has what we want to see. You know, we didn't care about sometimes the element of surprise. And again, I know the Perfect Bret match kind of had it, but you know, you knew the big show of the summer, everyone was going to get something blown off. And it happened on this night for the most part. So the Legion of Doom joins Virgil and Bret the Hitman Hart as new champions in the World Wrestling Federation. So,
and that leads us into our next match with again another debut on this show.
Yes,
and that is IRS Irwin R. Scheister, portrayed by a man we've once discussed on this show, a very familiar face, and that is Mike Rotundo.
Yep,
first pay per view appearance since the first WrestleMania when he and Barry Windham lost the tag team titles in a major upset to the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff.
Yes.
Rotundo then took off and headed to WCW/NWA/JCP in 87-ish, right? Late 87.
Well, before that, I think he went to Florida.
Right. Yeah.
Because our good friend Dr. G remembers that when he was he was getting into high school, Mike Rotundo came to his house because I guess one of Dr. G's friend's fathers was a wrestler. We've talked about it. And Mike Rotundo brought the Florida heavyweight title to his house, so he actually got to hold the actual Florida heavyweight championship belt. So I think he was there for a couple of years, and then he went to, to the NWA, and he actually became a member of the Varsity Club with our good friend Kevin Sullivan. And I used to like, and he was actually the TV champion. We just reviewed a couple of TV title matches with Rotundo. On our wonderful message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. Of course, Justin and I are currently reviewing NWA/WCW pay-per-views, and we reviewed the, I believe it was Clash 1, the first Clash, which had the match with Jimmy Garvin for the TV title. And because obviously Rotundo went to Syracuse, so he had a Syracuse singlet, and he had the orange boots, which I don't know, something about the orange boots I thought were cool.
And then things quickly derailed though for him, because he went from being the captain of the Varsity Club to being Captain Mike Rotundo, like a boat captain. He wore like a like a sailor's hat
and
a jacket. It was really fucked up.
Yeah, it was pretty stupid.
And then, but from there, in late 90, he became Michael Wall Street, kind of like a Wall Street gimmick, a businessman, financial man, managed by Alexander York, and he'd use a computer to help, help him figure out how long it would take him to win. Mm-hmm. And of course, Vince kind of kept that same idea for the gimmick. Of course, Vince was always battling with the IRS and the government, so I think this was supposed to be kind of a rib on them. But I will say this, from his debut through this show and on, IRS was a damn good talker in this gimmick. He really used to cut great promos week to week. Never flubbed, never slipped up, always got his point across. Very
the vignettes were
talker.
Great. Yeah, the vignettes were great. They really were. Yeah, I agree.
Very underrated talker. So and he's facing off here with the man making his final pay-per-view appearance under his own name. That's Greg Valentine. Final record 4-16. Oof. 0-5 at the Rumble, 2-5 at WrestleMania, 0-2 at SummerSlam, and 2-2 at Survivor Series. So Valentine's had a good run, a lot of memorable matches, a lot of good moments. He'll pop up time to time in different roles and whatnot. And we'll talk about him, obviously, when he gets to the Hall of Fame.
What are his four wins? Well, let's see. He won at WrestleMania 3.
WrestleMania 4.
He won the six-man tag, and then he won the his first tournament match at WrestleMania 4. And then the two at Survivor Series, what was he on, the 80? Was he on the heel?
Yep. Oh, no, not 88.
I think we still the Dream
89. Team. 89.
Yeah.
89 to 90.
Okay. He wasn't in the either 87 or 88 tag? I guess not.
He was, but he was on the losing team in 87.
That's right.
And then 88, he lost to the Warriors team.
That's right. So, and then he didn't, obviously, five Rumbles, five losses, including the loss to Ronnie Garvin. And then only two SummerSlam matches. This one and...
Hercules.
Hercules.
With two red feet. Well, actually, I guess we counted that as a loss. I don't know. That was kind of a weird... He technically won, but then Garvin reversed the decision, so I don't know.
Just because he
gets a loss for being involved in that match.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's the only two matches at SummerSlam. This one and...
We just said it. The Hercules match.
Oh, the Hercules match. That's right. Okay.
You're still hot over the LOD?
Well, I'm taking off my shoulder pads. So, no. So there you go. So 20 matches, 16 losses. Obviously, Valentine's WWF career was much better in the pre-pay-per-view era, 82 through 86, in essence.
Yep.
And then he pretty much became a jobber after that, so... nothing fancy, you know, pretty much a match to put over, you know, the new heel IRS, and the Hammer would end up heading to, I think he would go to WCW for a short time, and then he pretty much vanished.
Well, he would pop up in late 93 under a different gimmick, and he's actually in a couple of Rumbles, so he'll be in the 92 Rumble and 94 as well, so.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll see him a few more times.
Right.
This is his last official singles match.
Right. And I might as well, you know what, should I bring up my story now about our trip to Beverly? I might as well mention it now since last time we...
I think we did, well, we talked about it when... I mean, it was Eddie Edwards we talked about it.
Yeah. When we went Justin and I and our two of our... Well, Matt Rotella and another Place to Be podcast guest, Andy Flanagan, went to our friend John Walters' show up in Beverly right before WrestleMania 25, I guess. Yeah, it was a show at whatever that New Age NEWF or whatever that federation is.
Big Time, wasn't it?
Big Time. It was Big Time. That Cena's dad is in, and Great Hammer Valentine was there. And I told this story to my brother the other day, and he almost—I think he pooped himself. But I said, I can't believe I never told him the story. A lot of these house shows or a lot of these indie shows, they have tables and you can buy merchandise. They actually sold WWE merchandise. They actually sold TNA stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Remember we were holding up the TNA title. But in the back of the hall or whatever the room was, there was a table full of DVDs and stuff and various, you know, tapes and stuff. And in between matches, I remember walking over to the table, just looking at stuff. Remember you and I saw that huge, what was it, Primetime or Superstars? Somebody had like burned DVDs of like 5 years worth of Superstar shows.
Yeah, they had everything. Every Raw, Superstars.
Yeah, it was crazy. Smackdowns and everything. And all of a sudden, I start freaking out. I turn and Greg Valentine's standing right next to me. I was like, holy shit. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what to do. It was crazy. And he was looking at DVDs. I thought it was hilarious. So yep. I'm sitting here looking at DVDs of Greg the Hammer Valentine. And I said, oh, it's pretty good. He goes, yeah, I like looking to see if my stuff's here. I said, oh, just want to let you know, I'm a big fan. My brother's a big fan of yours. He goes, thanks, man. I said, you know, my brother loved the Dream Team. And he said, I said, you know, my brother had a picture on his wall of one of your favorite pictures of you that he cut out of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And he says, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the one where I was pointing at the back of my shirt that said, I broke Wahoo's leg. I literally couldn't move. I said, that's exactly right. He goes, everybody loves that picture, including me. It was just amazing. One of my favorite moments ever with anybody, just in a random conversation. It was just tremendous. I said that to my brother, and I swear to God, I think he crapped himself. It was awesome. So I always have a soft spot now for the Hammer. He's just a great guy. He really is.
Yeah, cool moment.
He looks no different.
No, definitely not.
He really aged well. He really did. I mean,
well, either aged well or he was young poorly.
Yeah, that's true too. He looked like 35 when he was 20. So, yeah. In any event, it was a cool moment. So, but this is pretty much it for the Hammer. He puts over IRS, and our new heel on the block. And, yeah, perfect character. Now, see, again, here's a guy. We talked about it when we were doing WrestleMania 1. You know, Rotundo went out a professional. You know, left the WWE as professional. Barry Windham left a tool.
Yep.
And we know who got IRS and who got the Widowmaker.
Yep.
So, there you go.
I mean, IRS will go on and we'll talk about him quite a bit over the next few years.
Yes.
We'll have quite the run.
Yep.
But yeah, good little match. IRS gets the win. Gets his finisher. Actually, he wins with a small package. But either way, you know what's funny, a little tidbit too, watching those superstars. IRS, actually, the first match he had brown tights on. He had the shirt and tie with brown tights, which was weird.
Did he really?
Yeah, then he switched to the dress pants.
I gotta find that.
Yeah, it was on his debut.
What was it, Superstars?
Yeah.
I'll have to find that.
If you look at my reviews, and actually, I finally put them all into categories. If you guys go to our message board, Bigelow34ProBoards.com, and you look under the reviews section, it's called Bigelow's Classics. And there's a thread for all my superstars. I kind of do like stream of conscious reviews while I'm at work, while I'm listening
They're
to shows.
Good.
So there's one in there. If you look through them, Scott, you'll find it.
Yeah, I've had a chance to look through all of them. I usually see them when you post them during the day. But
I did one of the Dusty Rhodes DVD yesterday.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't see that yet.
Yeah, I watched the DVD, so that was pretty good.
That was on the classics?
It's up for this month. For July, not for August. It was up.
So. Oh, okay. That's pretty cool. So IRS gets the nice win, and the Hammer, good man, always been big fan of yours, and he goes off into the sunset.
Let's get to our main event, and then we can bitch about what should have been.
Yeah, this is where we find, this is unfortunate, because we've had such an awesome night. We really have had a great night, and then we get to this, our main event. Why don't you lead us in, sir?
You want me to talk about it, or?
Oh yeah, it's your match. You're the That's right. Sorry about that. I put my shoulder pads off again. Sorry. Anyway, the match that's on right now is James.
You think you were getting married in 2 days?
Well, there's gonna be a lot of people I'm hanging around. I'll have to take care of that night. But our main event pits the World Wrestling Federation champion, who actually is not defending his title, the one guy who isn't, and that is of course Hulk Hogan, and his tag team partner, the Ultimate Warrior, takes on the newly named, well, not newly named, I guess they were given the name probably in like late April, early May, whenever their third guy debuted, the Triangle of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, of course, former World Wrestling Federation champion, Sergeant Slaughter, General Adnan, and a new guy, not really a new guy, but the returning Iron Sheik, who went by a new name. He went by Colonel Mustafa. I'm trying to remember. I know, you know, there was a Superstars episode and Slaughter made the big premiere, and Mustafa came down the ramp. But do they actually say that it was Iron Sheik?
Yep.
I thought so.
Yeah, they did.
And Slaughter called them the Triangle of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a 3-on-2 handicap match.
And it came out of nowhere.
It really did. Yeah, it really did. I mean, it was very strange.
But do you want to? Should we talk about the? All right, we got a lot to talk about. Should we talk about the Jake and Warrior stuff here?
Well, we'll do that for a minute. The first thing we'll do is, for those that don't remember, we didn't mention this at WrestleMania, but the night, I remember they showed it the week, the Superstars after after WrestleMania. Hogan is and Mean Gene are walking down the hallway in the back of the LA Sports Arena. Obviously, you know, Hogan's on cloud nine, first 3-time world champion, opens his locker door and gets pretty much ambushed by Slaughter and Adnan. So
they throw a fireball at him, right?
They throw a fireball at him, and then I think they stomp on him a bit and then leave.
Yeah.
So there was a whole big thing about nice Savage promo coming up here. And Leap and Lanny ironically just wrestled. So obviously they were planning on doing something after this match. And Hogan was actually off camera for like a month, I think, to sell the eye.
They were setting up a house show run as well, where they would you know, the series of rematches, but also have a bunch of Desert Storm matches, which are basically like bunkhouse brawls where they dress up in like camo gear and use weapons. And those were good matches. And
they were very good matches.
I kind of don't get why they didn't do that here if they wanted to continue this feud. At least have the title match. I guess the hook was to see Hogan and Warrior together, but Slaughter at this point, his promos were still good, and he was doing his best to keep his heat. But, you know, the Gulf War, all that shit was over.
That was way over. Yeah,
it just felt very anticlimactic at this point. And yeah. I just felt like there were so many other options they could have went with than this match. And, you know, it gets, I don't know. I guess, like I said, if you want to see Hogan and Warrior, this is kind of the last time they're together for a while. So, but to me, that's not enough of a draw to have this tag match.
Yes. And I had something. Oh, and it was weird, those bunkhouse matches, because the best thing about it was probably the first time in a long time that you see Hogan wrestling something other than the yellow and red.
Mm-hmm.
He actually has long camo pants on. He wears a camo t-shirt that he obviously rips off, and then he has a headband. Went along with, obviously, the motif of the match.
And the vest, too. I think he wore a vest, right?
Yeah, he wore like a vest, like one of those ones with all the pockets that have like things in it. So that's one part of this match. The other part of this match involved the other – well, there's three parts. It's actually a three-pronged story here. The first part of it, we obviously just talked about Hogan and Slaughter Adnan. Why don't you get into Warrior's end of the bargain and what could have been the main event of this match? But why don't we talk about the Warrior and what he was going through all summer?
Okay. So over the summer, Warrior began feuding with The Undertaker across the house shows and on TV. They were playing up, could Warrior defeat the Dark Side? Was he afraid of what Taker represented? They were supposed to be having body bag matches on house shows, so, you know, could he withstand facing death, basically?
Yeah.
So Jake Roberts showed up and said, yes, I will train you, Warrior, to not be afraid of Taker or caskets. So the classic vignettes that everyone has hopefully seen.
Yes.
With Jake training Warrior, where he had one where he locked him in a casket, one where he dug him and buried him in a grave, and another one where he locked him in a chamber of cobras. And of course, on that last one, a cobra popped out of a box that Jake kept imploring Warrior to open, and the cobra bit Warrior, and Jake, left Warrior locked in there, and then he opens the door, Warrior climbs out, he looks up, and then Taker and Paul Bearer are standing there staring down at him. So it was then revealed that Jake, Taker and Paul Bearer were all in cahoots, and Jake the Snake, after a lengthy face run, after the death of his friend Damien, has finally gone off the deep end and turned heel.
And a lot of us, you know, and he was a great babyface too. I mean, mm-hmm. he was over with the fans, but this was something very, very different.
Yeah, he needed a change. He was definitely reaching the end of it.
Mm.
Of his face run, I think, especially after they killed off Damien. They really, you know, he had that kind of tepid feud with Earthquake on the house show circuit. There really wasn't much more for him to do.
No, I agree. He would end up being, I mean, we'll document it more as we get along throughout the rest of the year, but he ended up being just an absolutely awesome heel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely awesome. Just so psychotic and crazy, and you thought the babyface promos were good. These were even better. These heel promos were better than his 86, early 87 heel promos. Those were good. These were awesome, and we'll document them throughout the next couple of weeks.
What I think they should have really done to really cap the show off was done Warrior Taker. Because they never really had that. So have that on pay-per-view. And then that way you're not blowing off Warrior Jake yet. You know, you're going to keep that going. And then you do Hogan Slaughter in the Desert Storm match. You know, those two matches on top of this card would have really propelled this.
Yes.
Instead of what we got. And, you know, even some combination. Even if you did Jake and Taker against Warrior and Hogan. You know, Warrior enlists his buddy Hogan to help him take out the Dark Side. Just to have this hot, hot heel team, Jake and Taker. And then not even on the show until the very end. They don't wrestle. And also another, team that we didn't even talk about that doesn't wrestle is the Rockers.
Right.
Red Hot 91 completely left off the show. It's just, as good as this show is, it's kind of weird. Maybe they could have the Rockers in the opener, teaming with the Bulldog, because they kind of always have that feud going with Power and Glory. It's just very odd that those four guys, Jake, Taker, and the Rockers were all left off this show.
Yes, I concur. Yeah. And for this is only the eighth match.
Yeah.
So obviously,
well,
something
basically,
happens.
Technically
well, because
nine. Yeah,
because something happens after this match that eats up the last half hour of the show. But so that sets up. So what Warrior was going through at this point had nothing to do with this match.
No,
which makes
it that's why
stupider.
It's weird. And they just announced it like out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, okay, Warrior's team with Hogan. What? He's involved with Undertaker and all this other stuff. Yeah, it was just very weird.
Yeah. And the third prong of this, the third aspect of this whole thing involved the special guest referee for this match. Another guy that I've always been a huge mark for, and this is one that I actually get a lot of crap for because, I don't know, probably because he's not an overly great wrestler, but I get a lot of crap for it, but he's always one of my, always been one of my favorites. And another guy that I never thought would be in the WWF, but, the vignettes were, they weren't really vignettes. They were like, what, like 10 second?
Yeah. 6-8 was the first one.
Yeah. It would be like this weird music, be like strange, like ghoulish music. And then his face would come up and he'd, the vignettes would change. He would smile. He would giggle. He would cackle. He would snarl. He would do all these weird facial features. I am talking, of course, about huge stud wrestler and softball player extraordinaire, Sid Justice. And he, of course, would be more known by his NWA WCW name of Sid Vicious. And he was a horseman. Not a very good one, but he was. And he had that look. He had that look of a guy that easily could be a bona fide top-level world champion superstar anywhere in any promotion in the world. He just had that look. And when he was in WCW, he was in essence a, you know, a bit player with a horseman and, you know, some mid-card stuff, and he was in a couple of pay-per-views, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And then he came here, and like I said, June 8th, the weird vignettes. And then out of nowhere, he is signed to be the guest referee for this match.
Well, here's what happened. On July 6th is when they announced this match out of nowhere. Warriors, right. Not even involved, they throw him in the match. 7:20, after the Sid stuff had been airing for really a while now, during a Triangle of Terror interview with Mean Gene, Sid is officially announced as the guest referee for this match, so July 20th. And then they would tease over the weeks whose side would Sid kind of be on, Hogan, right. Warrior or Sarge and his boys.
Yeah, it was kind of almost mimicking the main event of 3 years earlier, the Mega Bucks versus the Mega Powers, when it was the whole big thing about what side Jesse would be on. So similar vein there. I was pretty excited. I was always a big Sid fan, and it was cool to see him. It was cool to see him in the WWF. So it was very cool. You could see now, just suddenly, all of a sudden, Vince was really loading this roster up. I mean, he was getting guys. Of course, we talked about the guy that Bobby mentioned earlier, him. And now Sid's here, and
yep.
IRS, and really, Vince was really doing a great job of really jacking this roster up. And, you know, by the beginning of the following year, it would pay off in spades, but we'll get there.
And, of course, there actually is one more story we need to talk about leading into this match. A lot going on. And that is Ultimate Warrior's contract situation was kind of
shaky. A little behind-the-scenes action, yes.
Okay. And he was balking at even showing up for this show. He did show up. But before he said he would go through the curtain, he demanded Vince pay him a bonus, more money. Vince could not see his SummerSlam main event go up in flames minutes before it was about to happen, so he caved, told Warrior he'd pay him, and then as soon as Warrior came back to the curtain, as the story goes, Vince fired him immediately. So that was that. So Warrior, his long run, successful run, comes to an abrupt end here. Not a long end, though. He will be back very soon. But as of now, he is no longer a WWF wrestler.
No, and I don't blame Vince. I mean, you know, for all the great things that I've said, and I said it, I really put him over, obviously, last week's Vintage Vault. When he showed up for the big match, he delivered. The problem was, a lot of the rest of the time, he was a whiny little bitch who thought his shit didn't stink. And
just a straight up dick move.
Yeah, he really was a douchebag.
Say what you want about Vince, but I mean that was a shitty thing to do to the promotion in general.
Yeah, you may be dicking over, you know, Vince, but you're dicking over your coworkers and mm-hmm. you know, blowing a good payday and a buy, you know, they get pieces of the buy rate and things like that. So it's horse shit and you know, good riddance. It made the match even, you know, just thinking about it now almost made the match even worse. Do we cover everything? I feel like
yes. Except for the match itself, which is nothing special. I said it's a generic you would expect it to be. And of course, Warrior runs and chases. I think he chases Adnan to the back. And then Hogan's left alone. He overcomes, gets the win with Slaughter. Then they kind of stop. You know, they start attacking him again, and Sid makes a save and helps Hogan. And then him and Hogan pose to end the. Wrestling part of the show.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, Hogan would pose with Sid. Incidentally, just to give a little more backstory on Sid's background, he spent most of his early career in Alabama and Memphis. He was with Lawler's crew. He was Lord Humongous in the House of Humperdinck. Then he would go on to Crockett, Jim Crockett Promotions. He was a former horseman. He was in the Skyscrapers with Dan Spivey, or as our good friend, what does our good friend, the Duke, call him?
Spivey.
Yeah, Dan Spivey. And then his last claim to fame in 1991 at War Games, which was probably about 4 months before this show, or maybe 5 or 6 months before this show, was in a War Games match where he almost kills your future J-Fave, Brian Pillman.
Yes.
By he just has no room to do his power slam, a power bomb, so he drops Pillman on his head. And that ends up stopping the match, and the Horsemen win. So that was Sid's career. And then Sid would make things even worse for himself down the line, but, you know, we'll get there.
Yep.
So there you go. There's your wrestling portion of SummerSlam 1991. The first 7 matches were all very good with a lot of backstory and matches that all had great endings and a hot crowd. And then this colossal piece of crap is thrown at us in the main event.
It's not even that bad. It's just... it's more about the potential that could have been.
Right. When you mentioned exactly 3 very hot entities in the promotion, The Undertaker, Jake the Snake, and the Rockers, all not even on camera. It's befuddling. None of them are hurt, you know?
Right.
Very strange. Very strange. Now, obviously, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that, you know, this was definitely the match made in hell. Well, obviously, there needs to be another half of that, you know, another half of that cliche, if you will, and that is the match made in heaven.
Elizabeth!
Now, of course, after WrestleMania, when his career ended, Savage started commentating on Superstars, moved over to the booth. Yep. Pretty good three-man booth, him, Vince, and Piper. But he continued to really much play the heel for a while.
Yes, yep.
A lot longer than I realized he did. And then,
pretty much through July, right, in essence? Or late June?
I think it's even later than that, honestly. Even after that proposal and stuff, he was still kind of doing a little bit heelish tendencies. Mm. Again, I narrate it in those reviews, and I do say the point where he finally stopped. You know, Vince started up a couple weeks before that proposal saying that there were rumors in the air and all this other shit, and Piper would kind of try and get him jazzed up, and then finally happened on that episode of Superstars. Liz says yes, the wedding set for SummerSlam. They're gonna get married in Madison Square Garden. They had the bachelor party on primetime, which is pretty funny. And then of course here after the main event, they take the whole ring apart, rechange it into an altar. They bring out the priest, and this might be the one wrestling wedding that was actually a wedding. There was no, you know, there's an angle later, but the actual ceremony goes off without a hitch.
Yeah, no run-ins or, nobody comes up through the ring floor or the canvas or any of that nonsense. It actually was a legitimate ceremony.
Yep, so that's it. They get married, the show goes off the air, but they would be busy off air filming, filming a little bit for television, of course.
Yes, because obviously with a wedding, with a ceremony, as we will see Saturday, comes a reception.
And hopefully Matt's reception is not quite like this one.
Well, I tell you something, if something comes out of, well, I'm not even going to, let's explain it, but I don't know.
Interview and invitation.
At least we know the music at Rotella Fest Saturday will be better than that.
Hopefully.
That's for sure. But so they shoot the the reception, and there's all, you know, dancing, and it's fairly hideous.
Yeah, well, they did the cake, and Liz throws the thing, and it looks like the lamest wedding reception ever, to be honest.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. Yeah, it was pretty awful.
So but then they go to do the gifts.
And, which is very strange, because you don't open the gifts at the reception, so I thought that was pretty funny, too.
And this one they did. And then chaos ensues.
Yes.
As your union in marriage.
What should have been the happy conclusion to this perfect occasion was suddenly marred by this.
I'm gonna save the
Blender. I'd like to know, You know, for a guy who's known so many people in the wrestling business, what kind of cheap bastards do you invite to your wedding that are only going to give you a blender and candlesticks?
Their whole reception was, like, so cheesy, but the end was tremendous, of course. And what happened is they open the box, the Cobra pops out, and Jake and Taker come crashing through. Taker clocks Savage with the urn, knocks him out cold, and Jake teases Liz with the Cobra yelling at her. And that would start a pretty much a four-month run of torture from Jake to the Savage family.
Yes, pretty much.
And, of course, they had to do this with Warrior leaving, you know, trying to transition Jake and Taker into a feud with Savage and Sid as well, who made the save there. So
yeah,
well, that was kind of set to be their big fall.
Yes.
False.
Sid with his Fabio-esque silk red shirt that he was wearing. This reception was just ridiculous on so many levels. But just now, we can finally just say it. Jake was just absolutely awesome.
Yes.
Period.
Without a doubt.
I mean, he had been waiting for this moment just to be an absolutely psychotic freak. And then you just have Taker, this running, you know, my running buddy is this big 6'8", 300-pound friggin' ham hock.
Yep.
I mean, what a team. Really, what a team of monsters. And this, incidentally, again, as Justin mentioned, this was not at SummerSlam. The show went off the air at the end of the ceremony. This was on Superstars.
Challenge, primetime, everything.
Primetime, yeah. It was the whole following weekend. This dominated. And it was just awesome. Yep. Awesome. Elizabeth scream, and then Savage turns around and fucking Taker knocks him cold with the urn.
Yep.
He's out cold. Jake, just such an absolute asshole, just waving the Cobra in Elizabeth's face. I mean, it was just great.
Yep.
It was tremendous programming. This, to me, almost, if it would have actually been on the SummerSlam show, would have actually maybe made it one of the greatest ever. Because this would have swallowed up that disaster of a main event.
Yes.
For me, this would have taken that over. And but
I can understand why they didn't do it, though, on pay-per-view. It would have been awkward.
Yeah, you want it to end nicely, obviously.
Because they're not going to show the whole reception, so they had to make it into a package.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, who the heck would want to sit through an hour of blenders, candlesticks, and cheesy porn music? So, you know, it was – but. Jake and they was just, it was just awesome. I mean, as great a babyface as he's been, man, he just knows how to be one sick son of a bitch. And he just gets better. This just gets better from here. Just gets better from here. And Taker, you just see it now. Now you just see it. The guy, this is a character that's not some flash in the pan. He's going to be around for a while. And, it continues to lead us through the fall, and obviously next week on the Vault, when we talk about Survivor Series, we'll continue to bring you along on this journey of you put that very well. Jake attacks the Savage family. Very good way to put it. So again, that was not part of the show, but that is your SummerSlam 91. As bad as that main event is, I give the show an A. It's one of the greatest top to bottom shows of all time. Every match has a great backstory, whether it's a good in-ring match or just a great story with a great climax, an unbelievably awesome Garden crowd as usual. You know, it just one of my, this is one of those shows. I don't know if you agree with me or not. This is one of those shows where I can just put it in. It's like Billy Joel with me. I can put Billy on any time of the day, any time of night, regardless of what mood I'm in, and I can enjoy it. That's how I feel about this show. I'm like this with WrestleMania 3. I can just throw this show in whenever I'm in the mood, and I'm fine with it. It just always puts me in a good mood just watching the show.
I mean, it's a ton of fun. A lot of great stories, a lot of great angles, a lot of great blow-offs. You know, one great match, and the rest of the matches are all good. Nothing's bad. Even the main event is still solid. I mean, there's no match probably under like a 2, 2.5 level. So
right.
A very memorable card. Definitely one of the best, you know, when you factor in the whole package. Can I say it's the best in-ring card ever? No. But sometimes cards aren't meant to be that way, so.
Right, right. So there is SummerSlam 1991, top to bottom. Well, top to almost bottom.
Yep.
A tremendous show. After that, it's...
And the main event's not even more about the main event sucking or anything. It's more about the missed opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, when you see these unbelievably awesome crowds and the guys at the end of this, you know, piece that we see on Superstars and all that stuff the following week, you realize all these awesome guys are off the card. I mean, Where is Jake in some form? Where is Taker in some form? I think the one that even annoys me more than those two is where are the Rockers? How do you leave the Rockers off? I mean, two straight awesome pay-per-view matches. Obviously, the Orient Express at the Rumble, and then Barbarian and Haku at WrestleMania. They've been on fire. How do you leave them off?
I mean, the only place they could have maybe had them, like I said, is the six-man. Or I guess you could have put them with the Disasters, but I don't know if you want to have...
Well, the only reason you don't do that is because... Yeah. The only reason that not putting there would make no sense is because you actually had a natural thing there with the Bushwhackers, because
right,
that's, so that's who...
The only spot they could have really been in is if they... I mean, Tornado didn't need to be on this card. And, you know, Dragon, I guess, but, I mean, he didn't really need to either. They didn't have any substantial plans for him.
Right.
You know, they could have done easily Rockers and Bulldog against Tornado, against Warlord and Power Glory very easily.
Right.
So
why don't we get to the feedback?
Okay.
And once again, and kudos to our wonderful Place to Be Nation. You guys wrote like small theses. Theses.
They basically did their own reviews.
I know, really. This is crazy. We're not going to read. We have to scold one of our PTBers for what
they
did.
He knows. He knows what he did. I already rubbed his nose in his.
Yes, you did rub
his
nose
left
in
on our message board.
Yes, we'll get to that. So why don't we do? Justin and I are going to split the feedback this week because. It's just a lot of it. I'll do our Facebook page, Place to Be Podcast, and then Justin will do our good friend Graham Broham.
Graham official Cawthon. Happy birthday to Graham. Today is
yes.
his 30th birthday.
Yes, it is. Official happy birthday to Graham, Graham Cawthon, the purveyor of the history of WWE.com. Justin will do that feedback in a few minutes. All right, we begin with my good friend, Triple H fan and Laker extraordinaire, Corey Ferreira. What a show SummerSlam 1991 is. Easily one of the all-time best SummerSlam pay-per-views in history. The opening tag match is entertaining. The faces go over to get us started. Next, the best match of the night, Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect for the IC title. What a match. Even though Hennig's back was in a bad state, it was amazing. He had this caliber of a match, and he had put Bret over, and so begins the epic Bret Hart push. That's all one sentence, incidentally. The Bush, this is like stream
of consciousness.
Like
a Lakers fan, Triple H fan, but not a very good grammar fan.
It's kind of like your stream of consciousness reduced. The Bushwhackers and Natural Disasters is nothing that special. Andre gets his last time in the spotlight. Virgil and DiBiase is fine. Amazing they gave Virgil the win and the $1 million title, but I guess they wanted Virgil to have a decent mid-card run. The Boss Man beats the Mountie, which leads to some great vignettes, with the Mountie getting arrested and going into jail. Great stuff. Legion of Doom get the tag team titles from the Nasty Boys. Right choice to give the belts to the Legion of Doom, the new big team in the WWF. IRS defeating Valentine is nothing major. The main event is fine. Amazing Vince bled the Iraq-US angle until summer 91. Amazing seeing Hogan and Warrior team together, this being one of the first times putting them together since WrestleMania the prior year. The WWF obviously had to deal with Warrior backstage and have made it into Warrior wanted more money on the spot this night, and then they told him to get out right after the show. Next, the wedding of the late, great Macho Man Randy Savage and Elizabeth, and the first major WWF on-screen wedding, and still seen as the best in many people's eyes. Not much to say about this, just a great moment. Overall, a great show, but damn, it's left with a bad legacy of performers who have died. Bulldog, Texas Tornado, Hercules, Mr. Perfect, Coach, Earthquake, Andre, Sherry, Bossman, Hawk, Savage, Elizabeth, Gorilla, Lord Alfred Hayes, and Joey Morella have all passed on. 16 in total. Apart from the loss of the performers over the last 20 years, this is still remembered as one of the best SummerSlams done by the WWF/E. Well done, Corey Ferreira.
Yes.
Even though that was like three sentences.
Great as always, Corey, the man.
Yes. Jared Incel. Top to bottom, SummerSlam 91 is a solid pay-per-view card. I always get a kick out of the show's opening video package where Vince McMahon goes on about nuptials turning to napalm.
Napalm!
Napalm! Hell! This is followed by ridiculous live-action screenshots of Slaughter, Adnan, and Mustafa growling at the camera.
Yes.
And then Hogan and the Warrior posing, but not quite looking right.
Yep.
Warrior in particular looks like he was hit with a taser or a can of bear mace.
Yes. I forgot to mention that in the open.
Isn't that where he's pumping his pecs, too?
Yeah, I think it's all fucked up. It's really funny. The growling is tremendous.
Yes. The show itself has a lot of memorable moments with Bret Hart versus Mr. Perfect is obviously the match of the night. As a diehard Hitman fan, this was a long time coming for me as Bret's solo pushing was finally coming to fruition. The Mountie in the New York City jail was priceless, and the commentary team of Monsoon, Heenan, and Piper were in top form as always. The main event was pretty weak, though, as the Gulf War had long been over by this point. Taking this into account, it seems strange that Jake the Snake Roberts and The Undertaker were strangely MIA on this show, apart from the wedding reception. By the way, that segment was only included on the Coliseum video version. Well, and of course it was on the following week's programming.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, one of the better SummerSlam pay-per-views for sure. P.S. The look of General Adnan's face when Sean Mooney is interviewing the Triangle of Terror in the locker room area is hilarious. The man looks completely stoned. He probably was, knowing him. Okay. Paul McGrady. Oh, new, another newcomer. Paul McGrady.
Yep.
Wedding sucked. Reception was better. We got a blender. Yeah. That's very well done. Oh, Paul McGrady also says, the thought that Warrior was holding McMahon up for more money or he wouldn't go out to wrestle is comical. That was the birth of the whack job Warrior. Our good friend.
J. Arsenio D'Amato.
That's right. Bret Hart ripping Perfect's tights is a moment etched in my memory forever. This was one of the first times where a title changed on a submission. That is true. MSG exploded for LOD, taking the title just like a particular PTB host. Exploding is not the right word.
Oh, yes, it is.
Okay. Jason Greenhouse, another one of our loyal listeners. If it takes place at MSG, then you know you're in for a treat. This event was no exception. The Garden was rocking that night. Fun opening six-man tag match. Bret Hart versus Mr. Perfect is one of the best matches in WWE history. The Mountie Jail segments were priceless. LOD capturing the tag team gold was something that fans were anticipating since they came to the WWF, and what a better place for it to happen than at MSG. The match made in hell served its purpose. It got Hogan and Warrior a main event win and introduced the WWF fans to Sid. Besides that, it wasn't anything special. It's sad to see, so sad to see Andre in the state that he was in. Unfortunately, it's the boss's last pay-per-view appearance. The video package that was shown before the wedding was very touching back in 1991. 20 years later, watching it, it is even more emotional, as is the wedding itself. The wedding reception events are the beginning to one of my favorite feuds of the era, Randy and Jake, and who can forget how amazing Gorilla Bobby and the Brain were on commentary. Okay. Austin Pfaff. SummerSlam 91 is a great show. So many great moments and matches like Bret Perfect and LOD Nasties. The aftermath of the jailhouse match with Mountie and Jail is timeless, along with Heenan's great commentary as well. The wedding is the only wrestling wedding I can recall going off without a problem. However, I just thought of something. Imagine if we had heel Hogan from NWO days here. He would drug Liz and marry her just like Mr. Helmsley did with Stephanie. But anyway, the wedding as a whole is not easy to watch for obvious reasons, but still a great show. Brian Samick. He actually has a couple of comments here, but Brian Samick. SummerSlam 1991 had mixed reactions for me. I love the Bret Hart versus Kurt Hennig title change, not only for the changing of the guard, but also because Kurt went out there in major pain and busted his ass for Hart just to make sure it looked good. I really feel the title change ended the old Federation years, IC title days, and started the next phase years in the WWF. That's a good point. From here, the IC title started a slow descent that, although taking a while, made it less and less important, leading to today where it's meaningless. I hate the wedding personally, as I just don't like that shit in wrestling. The match made in health, I think, delivered well for those involved in it. That feud went on way too long, Hogan Warrior versus Slaughter friends, so that it was great to end here. Hogan and Slaughter had some really good house show matches in between WrestleMania and SummerSlam that they could have blown that off here instead of put Warrior versus Undertaker in what would have been another huge matchup. Instead, Taker is nowhere to be found. This could have been the beginning of the rise to eventually winning the WWF title in November. Love the show. You guys give me great shit to listen to while working in IT.
I thought he meant working in shit, working in it.
Well, it says it, so I'm assuming IT. Austin Pfaff comes back with, one more thing I almost forgot. Thank God for downtime at work. This was the event where Ultimate Warrior apparently held McMahon up for money. Now I ask you, do you feel that he had probably deserved what he was asking? In my opinion, he might have. You guys had a point when it needed to be time, Warrior brought it.
I don't
think the money was the problem. It's just being a douchebag five minutes before you go through the curtain.
Yeah, that's the problem with it. That's the problem we have with it, is the timing, not the fact that he wanted a raise. I'm sure he probably deserved one, but the timing was not.
No, you're not
optimal.
Don't be an asshole. Exactly. Brian Samick comes back with another comment.
It's the antithesis of what he should have done.
Yeah, I knew you were waiting to try it again. Brian Samick comes back with, agreed, he brought it when needed, but the WWF gave him his chance to be famous, rich, have tons of little warriors, merchandise, etc. And to hold them up, Vince, for more money or you won't go out and perform at a big show for the same company is bullshit in my opinion. Do your job and worry about the money afterward. It would be like me holding up my company for more money or I won't give training to a bunch of people that will end up making my company look bad. Well, not exactly like that, but you get the idea. Poor Brian, bad company. I know he's not the first or last to do this, but it's crap either way. Okay. Dave Hall. A very solid card, but I always felt the main event was a big letdown. Hogan and Show Me the Money Warrior were up against a manager, a guy who had lost his heat when beaten at WrestleMania, and Colonel Mustache, Mustafa, a man who could barely move. Even the use of Sid couldn't save this match. Don't know why they couldn't have made the match Undertaker and Jake, especially as Warrior had been feuding with both of them. How the top two heels in the company couldn't make the card is beyond me, especially when one is due to face the champ at the next pay-per-view. The rest of the card was great, though, with the return of Ricky Steamboat, the arrival of IRS, and the pay-per-view debut of the Natural Disasters. You had a good mix of new attractions. Mix that with one of the greatest IC title matches ever, the rise of LOD to the belts. Will Scott be able to review the match through his excitement? Clearly, as you could tell, I didn't, because I couldn't keep up with the next two matches. And the Mountie's antics at the county jail, and you have a lot of entertainment. I also really love Bobby Heenan's attempts to embarrass Hogan, challenging him on behalf of Ric Flair, only to have the door slam on him. Great little segment that should have launched a pay-per-view program, but never eventuated. Eventuated?
I like that word.
Is that, kind of like, is that like kind of you with antithesis? Antithesis?
I guess so.
Antithesis. We'll get into the whole Hogan Flair. We're not going to do that now. That's another three hours.
Yeah, we got time for that.
Yeah. I've always found the wedding segment a little slow. All the action was at the reception, which was on the video, but the live crowd could have missed. But the rise of Brett and no Hacksaw Jim Duggan made this a very tough. Seems kind of hollow tonight.
I got the American flag.
Seems kind of hollow tonight.
American flag, American flag.
I think Simon Cowell.
I got my 2x4.
What's is that guy burping in the background?
It sounds like you.
I got my 2x4 over my other shoulder. I start going through the screen. Uh-oh. The people start saying, USA! USA! The hell is my neck stands straight up. The blood starts pumping through my heart. The air's in my lungs. I get a big oh!
So to pay the price for him not being on the show, you have to play the whole damn song? And, folks, he's certainly not in the category of Taker, Jake, and the Rockers as not being able to play.
USA! USA!
Yeah, no check for you, Sunshine. Keep looking for Sapphire, okay? Anyway, thank you, Dave. That was a highlight right there. Certainly not listening to that, but anyway. Tyler Anderson says, SummerSlam 91 was the first pay-per-view I watched live. I'd been a huge fan for about 3 years to that point. The biggest thing I remember was how almost all the faces won, all of the titles were now held by faces, including the Million Dollar Championship, and how Bret Hart started his mega superstar run as a singles wrestler. Matt Farrell says, enjoyable show, but I wish the reception was on my copy of the event. Hart Perfect is an amazing match, and the rest of the card is entertaining. Each match added something nice to the show. I have the Coliseum video copy. I think the reception's on it. Pretty sure it is. And now, our comment of the evening from Kieran Polland.
The Hot Scott!
Yes. The show overall is very enjoyable. The Bret Perfect match is awesome and is the first of many great pay-per-view matches for the Hitman. Perfect coming in despite a bad back earns my respect, much like the Steel Cage match the year before, the main event just feels like filler. Instead of continuing the Hogan-Slaughter feud, why not do Hogan and Warrior versus Jake and Taker? That way, if Warrior was leaving, you could blow off the feud with Jake and you could build towards Hogan-Taker and Survivor Series at the same time. You could still have Sid as the referee and Taker and Jake crashing the reception afterwards. It's sad watching the wedding 20 years later, not knowing that both Macho and Liz are dead. Virgil Mania was running wild, and Virgil got a huge pop. Hopefully, A-Rai doesn't end up jobbing on superstars like Virgil ended up doing. LOD winning the tag titles, much to Scott's orgasmic delight, and Mountie spends the night in the jail. I hope that at Matt Rotella's wedding, Scott gets arrested and has to spend the night in a jail cell with Hacksaw Jim Duggan. I am stunned.
So, you know, have you seen Sapphire, baby?
No, I haven't, Dust, but we're all still looking for her.
Yeah, that's why you didn't show up at SummerSlam, because you were lost. But, you know, Todd Weber talked about...
He's young and he's strong.
Talked about Triple H bringing out Duggan on Raw Monday would be like Triple H throwing me through the barbershop window like Sean did to Marty.
That was Rob Houston.
Rob Houston. Why do I keep giving Todd Weber that? Rob Houston. Well, I keep forgetting about him anyway. But,
USA!
Kieran Pollan, the Hot Scott, you, my friend, just threw me through the barbershop window.
USA!
I don't know if I can forgive you for that. Also, something I forgot to mention. Oh, and of course, he has to add a second. Maybe I won't even read this this comment. Also, something I forgot to mention in WrestleMania 7. Oh, now we're going to backtrack now? This show's totally gone off the rails. First, Slaughter laughing like an evil bad guy in a James Bond film after describing Hogan lying face down on the mat. And secondly, Mean Gene calling Alex Trebek his longtime close personal friend, and Alex goes on to call him Jim.
Funny stuff.
I'm still picking the glass out of my face after Kieran Pollan just threw it through the barbershop window.
Picking it out of your pants pockets, Adam Murray style.
Yes. On Lifetime. On the Lifetime Network for women. All right, so there is all of your... I can't believe we still got more to read.
Oh, I know. I'm going to try and blow through this. All right.
Yes, this is all... that was our Place to Be podcast, our Facebook page comments. Justin will now go to the wonderful Graham Cawthon's History of WWE Facebook page comments, and go right ahead, sir.
All right, maybe I should turn up Duggan's song again for this first one by Sam Ho. Ho!
Ho!
Mountie's going to the Slammer. Thank you, Sam. Brennan Whitehead, SummerSlam 91 was not a great pay-per-view, in my opinion. What? The Bret Perfect IC match is a classic, minus the presence of Coach. And DiBiase Virgil is elevated from mediocre to pretty good due to Piper's commentary, but the main event was quite lackluster, and I was infuriated by LOD Nasties, which is billed as no holds barred, but had teams tagging in and out. I don't like the wedding either. The reception was much better. Paul O'Grady, we got a blender. Yeah. Jim Rooney, the first pay-per-view I had watched on pay-per-view. Charles Barnett, I love a lot of new names this week. Charles Barnett, I love the Boss Man versus Mounty Jailhouse match. It's my favorite match of SummerSlam 91. Tony Nagel, I put down on my blog that this is my seventh favorite pay-per-view of all time, for good reason, too. It's a show that mixes sports and entertainment beautifully. Not every match needs to be great in order to make a great show. The match made in hell was a chore to sit through, but at least the match made in heaven wasn't. Bret and Perfect is one of the best IC title bouts of all time, and the Mounty Jail will forever haunt my soul. Grand the Broham, fantastic undercard, crap fest main event. So in other words, 1997 WCW. Paul McGrady again. The reception made up for the main event only if you watch the Coliseum video version and not the pay-per-view live. After Bret and Perfect, you were expecting a good main event, but that quickly turned to crap. The wedding was boring, but the rest of the undercard is great. Decent show. Jay Hinchy, yes, the first SummerSlam I saw, and it's still my favorite to this day. From three title changes with Bret winning the IC title, LOD winning the tag titles, and Virgil winning the $1 million title, the wedding was cool to me, and the main event wasn't that bad. It still holds up. Awesome SummerSlam overall. And I forgot to mention the jailhouse match with Bossman and Mountie. Mountie's jail segments were pretty damn funny as well. So thank you all for checking in with your feedback. As always, tremendous stuff. And Scott, I think we're running a little long, so I think we should maybe start wrapping up with our major announcement. Just quickly, we'll get into more of this on Monday.
Yes.
But we do have a major announcement. Our next big interview coming up on August 15th, so a week from this Monday, we are interviewing the great Stevie Richards, Michael Manna, of course, you know, star in ECW, WCW, WWF, TNA, part of the BWO, all kinds of different gimmicks, seen a lot, been done a lot, been on the roads a lot. So, of course, he is currently in Lucha Libre USA, which will be debuting soon on MTV2, so we'll chat with him about that. But again, get us your questions and comments or feedback for Stevie. You can do it on the Facebook page for either Place to Be Podcast or History of WWE, or the Place to Be message board at Bigelow34ProBoards.com. Again, we will be talking to Stevie Richards. So thank you again for listening to SummerSlam 91. We will be back on Monday with our SummerSlam Listomania and the recap of the Rotella wedding. And then next week, we'll be talking Survivor Series 91 as well. And then, of course, the Stevie Richards interview. So
yes,
thank you for listening. We will talk to you soon.
Peace. We'll be right back.